Hello, this is the Oz Media Report with me, Dan Barrett. We're back for episode 2. Each week on the podcast, I explore the areas where media, technology, and culture meet, usually with an Australian perspective. Every week, you can expect to hear conversations with media professionals and commentators who'll explain some of the broader issues the media is currently grappling with. We have two interviews this week. First up, we have Aaron Young. Just over a year ago, the former Sky News reporter launched a streaming video platform called Ticker TV. Throughout the day, you can tune in and watch rolling news coverage, along with interviews throughout the day, and dedicated programs looking at the world of sports, entertainment, the media, and more. Oh, and it's ad-free. He's done a great job in getting Ticker out there. I watch it occasionally through Twitter, where he has a partnership, but it's also streaming through platforms like YouTube and LinkedIn and the Ticker TV app. With Ticker recently celebrating 1 year, we check in with Aaron and find out about Ticker TV and where he plans taking it in the future. After that, we chat with Byteside editor Seamus Byrne about the recent announcements about new Xbox and PlayStation game consoles. These gaming companies have heralded the consoles as the next evolution in technology, but it leaves me with some pretty big questions about why these new machines feel like more of the same in a world where esports are going mainstream and virtual reality and augmented reality platforms are on their way to mainstream consumption. It's a really fascinating chat. But first, Ticker TV's Aaron Young. Let me kick off with a compliment. Ticker is probably the most interesting media product in Australia. I love the ambition. Australia, with its fairly small population, is a bit of a challenge for any media startup, let alone a video startup. But you've passed the 1 year mark, which I think speaks to some potential going forward.
Thank you so much and great to be here. Well, we certainly want to keep it interesting. And I think you've got to be interesting these days, don't you? There's so much media out there. There's so much that we can consume all the time that unless you're pushing boundaries, unless you're doing things differently, unless you're trying and giving it a go, why would anyone stop and give you any time?
Yeah, so let's maybe just start with the day-to-day of Ticker. How many staff do you have working on the product?
I think there's about 15, but you see, I don't see everyone at the same time. And given we're based in Melbourne, of course, where there's all these restrictions and things in place, we have teams of people who come into the office and then leave the office. So I was in this morning quite early doing the breakfast show, and then I'm home here having a chat to you now. I'll go back in later on just so we can keep, you know, the correct numbers of staff in the office at any one time. But we just keep growing. And we also, it's not just the full-time staff that we employ, but we also have hosts of shows who come in and use our facilities throughout the week.
And those hosts of the shows, are they essentially sort of running their own small business as a program, just sort of buying time on Ticker, or how does that actually work? Is it actually a commission program?
Sometimes they buy time. Sometimes we commission the programs. It really depends. Sometimes they are partnerships. We are extremely flexible. If there's one thing that you'd have to say about the media these days, it's that one size does not fit all. That goes from everything to the types of shows you do to the way they're produced. We have 15-minute shows that we think work really well on YouTube, for example. We have half-hour shows which are there to work for people's businesses. But they're all based on topics. It's consumer first. It's not about a small businessman going, you know, I've got a great idea, I want to do a show. We have plenty of people coming to us with queries about doing shows, but there has to be some value in it to our audience. Otherwise, we're never going to grow. We're just going to be LinkedIn on TV.
Yeah, in a way, I can kind of envision it being a little bit like the way that community TV used to operate, where you'd have people constantly knocking on the door saying, I've got a great idea for a show. Most of the time, those great ideas for a show weren't great ideas for a show. But, you know, it was still kind of the ability to think, hey, there's an open door here.
I think that's TV in general, though, isn't it? Like, imagine being the head of drama at a network and everyone who's ever had an idea or a great dream knocking on the door.
Yeah, at least there's a few gatekeepers along the way there, though.
Which I have been learning to create, I have to say. So I'm not as easy to get onto as I used to be, put it that way.
I know how to get into your DMs. It's all fine. Let's maybe just talk about the studio briefly. Whereabouts is it located? How big is it? And also, how have operations shifted for you in this sort of age of COVID?
Yeah, well, we started just over a year ago working at a co-working space in the CBD, and it was quite challenging for us. Co-working spaces aren't really designed to be TV studios, and as much as we tried to make it work, it was just too small. And obviously for us, the huge number of guests coming through the door is great for us, but not great for poor co-working spaces that have to staff it and deal with it. So we kind of worked out at the start of this year that it probably wasn't great and we needed a lot more space. And co-working spaces are pretty expensive for the space you get. They're kind of designed for staff at desks as opposed to TV studios and cameras and all the space that we require. So we started having a look around and found this really cool warehouse in Richmond right opposite the Rising Sun Hotel, which was the watering hole of the crew of Hey Hey Saturday back in the day, and literally around the corner of the old GTV building in Richmond. So I walk past it every day in Bendigo Street in Richmond. And we've got this really cool facility, which we've had to build and heavily invest in, as it used to be a gym before we were there. And we've used our imagination and come up with a really cool space. It's 250 square meters. And to be honest, we've already run out of space. So at the front is our office, which I share with our head of partnerships and commercial, and my dog, Tucker, as well. He's in there right now. And then outside that, we have a kind of, you know, kitchen hangout area where we all chill. And then we've got Studio 2, which is a soundproof 8 plasma screen semicircle. And then we've got our reception. And then we have our big newsroom barn, which is half the building, basically, which is where we have our control room and our producers and our main news studio.
Yeah. So you have had steady growth. You've been able to add a number of shows throughout the year. How is it you actually handle the programming? We have talked about that a little bit, but I'm wondering maybe about your strategy of commissioning specific types of shows as the state, as ticker. I want to call it a station. That's not right. It's a channel. As it grows, as it evolves.
Well, we're a network. We're a network, right? So we're not really a channel. We're not really a live stream. It's quite, when people say, you know, describe what ticker is. Ticker is what the modern media has to be. I mean, Channel 9 isn't a channel anymore. It's 9 now. It's Stan. It's so many different things. It's what you have to be these days. Mm. You have to be, your programming has to travel across many different formats. So that's what I look for when it comes to programming. I don't look for shows which are only going to work in a half hour format or only going to work in a 5 minute format. I look for shows where they're essentially shows of segments that can work as a 5 minute, a 15 or a half hour, sometimes an hour. I do a show in the morning where I have in half an hour about 6 to 10 guests that I just get straight through, reporters, and it's all designed so our social media team can quickly cut it up and get it out into places. Some segments are cut up for YouTube because that 10 minutes on Ticker Entertainment or Ticker Media works really well for people who want to have it playing in the background and catch up once a week. So we have a distinctly under 45s focus. And we try and imagine that our viewers are, we've got names for them. We've got Joel and Emily. Joel and Emily are both around 29 or 30 years old. They've got a good amount of income. They work in the CBD or did, and they live within a 5K ring of Melbourne CBD. What I noticed is that TV in this country has gone from being aspirational to being quite suburban. You know, you have a look at Today and Sunrise, great shows, very well produced. But they're going for the outer suburbs these days, and they've essentially left it to the ABC for the inner suburbs. But not all of us who live in the inner suburbs are ABC viewers, and we are quite commercial. And you'll see people who listen to Triple J who are quite commercial, and yet Triple J is so far away from any of the commercial stations. And the one thing that I've noticed traveling around the world and looking at the media, particularly in the US, is they cater for the middle as well, quite well. It's not just one or the other. You have a look at, say, in the US, you've got Fox and MSNBC and CNN. And now you've got things like Cheddar coming through and going, you know, there's a market for an under 45s urbanite who drinks their Starbucks coffee first thing in the morning, catches the train, wants to see the headlines, bit mistrusting of mainstream media. But they work for a huge bank, you know, and that's the people that we're talking to.
Yeah, these are my people. But I'm just thinking in terms of the actual programming that you've gone out and you've sought after. So obviously you've got your morning show, which is a little bit more general magazine format, but then you've got very specific sort of genres. Like you've got an entertainment program, you've got a media program, you've got yada, yada. Have you got a bit of a roadmap that you're working to, or is it maybe sort of growing organically as talent becomes available?
So we have news on the the top of each half hour. So we do news 8 through to 5 p.m. on the top half hour. We got a couple of shows in the middle of the day, which are hour-long formats. But generally, we have the half-hour shows, and we'll be expanding on that as well. So the idea is you can have that, you know, ticker on in your office when you're at work, and away you go. But our back half hours are made up of the shows that essentially help to brand what we are. See, Ticker isn't just meant to be a news channel. I mean, you'd be crazy to launch a news channel. You can't go up against the ABC's resources or Sky News for the opinion stuff. So we don't want to try and emulate anybody. But what we do want to do is to have something that you can be informed of what's going on in the world by journalists that you respect and that you trust. And then to have programs that you might be interested in. I see it all as circles, right? So we have a program called Ticker Sport, hosted by David Davidovich, who worked for the Herald Sun as chief football writer for quite a long time. And he gets massive guests. We had Pat Cash on the other day. We have, you know, the head of soccer on all the time. And so you might see that come up in your feed and go, oh, what is this ticker business? And you get in and you have a look at that. And while you're there, you discover that, you know, hey, they're talking about the radio industry. I like the radio industry. What are they talking about? And off it goes. So we actually try and think of the things that people who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s are really keen on, both in terms of being informed, but also getting a bit of an idea about from people who are quite accessible, people who are just like them. We don't try the polish of Channel 9 and all that sort of thing. We do want to be polished, but we want to be accessible as well. So that we don't really have a roadmap. It's more the sense that we know who we are. And when we spot something that fits in with who we are, we jump at it.
I'm also thinking you're in a fairly unique position at the moment where you're an organization that's on, you're growing at a time where a lot of the industry is in a retraction period. There's a lot of very talented people that are leaving places like the ABC and some of the more commercial media outlets. There's a lot of talent out there that you can really sort of pick and choose from. Are you having conversations with people as they become available on the market?
Oh, yes. I mean, I have to be honest, and please don't see this as boasting. I feel terrible saying this, but I'm actually scared of looking at my LinkedIn messages half the time. I go on there and it is, I'm inundated with people who work for massive news organizations, people who I know, people who I've worked alongside, and you know, I try and say yes to as many people as possible. Obviously, we have budgets, and quite often, if you've been on a $300,000 network salary, ticker probably isn't for you. But what we are for is for people who want to keep a kind of hand in the game at the moment. We understand that the industry isn't dead. It's going through a massive transition. It's a bit like musical chairs, and we're all up dancing around at the moment, and we have no idea how many chairs are going to be left at the end of all this, but there will be chairs left. So we are a place that can provide a bit of a transition for some people as well who are waiting to come back, and we don't mind that. I'm not the kind of executive in media who, you know, says you have to be here for the rest of your life, and if you talk to anybody else, that's the end of it. You know, you'll never work in this town again. So yes, absolutely, we talk to a lot of people a lot of the time. We've got people in the UK who work for, you know, major networks in the UK who've just been made redundant, saying, do you want to set up a UK bureau? We've got people in America saying the same thing as well. We do plan to move overseas. So what we're creating in Australia is a bit of a sandbox. What we've created works financially. We have figured out a really great formula for making money in a very tight media industry. And it works. Every month we look at the bank balance and go, gosh, it worked. So it's been opportunistic, I think is the word. And as a journalist, I mean, isn't that what we're meant to be doing, being opportunistic?
Yeah. Like when I actually think about what Ticker's doing, it seems very similar. Like it reminds me quite a lot of the defunct HuffPost Live. And I've often thought there was a bit of a space in the Australian market for something like a HuffPost Live.
I never saw it. I actually haven't seen it before. I have to check it out.
It's basically exactly what you're doing. So it was a 24-hour, but it wasn't quite. It was more like about a 15, 16-hour live stream. Show had programs broken out. So, you know, here's the arts and entertainment program. Here's the politics show. Largely what you're doing here on Ticker. And then there was also...
The biggest problem is you cannot rely on advertising. Yeah. Right? So Dan, a lot of people will start this and they'll put their hand out. They'll go and say that Foxtel will want to take them. So they'll go to Foxtel and they'll say, you know, I've got this great channel. We've got 15 hours. You know, why don't you guys pay us 20 cents per subscriber? And bang, you know, we've got a channel. We've got a business plan. What I've realized is that if your business plan right now, I think in any situation in the media, but particularly for a newcomer, is reliant on advertising, or reliant on a bigger media organization paying you money to say, thank you for coming on board, good luck. It's a little bit like having your chocolate cake and eating it too. It's just not going to happen. It's over. Those days are over. And I think we're seeing it right across the board. So you have to be completely able to sustain yourself, completely able to. And so we didn't look towards advertising. We never have. We don't have ads. We have partnerships with many different types of organizations. But we have the big banks now coming to us saying, how can we get involved? Because what we focused on was actually providing something that they couldn't get from a 30-second spot on a TV network. Because I realized very early on in my journalism career that editorial is where it's all about. It's what we all do. And we don't sell editorial. We don't sell. We don't say to people, you know, come on and we'll pretend to do an interview with you and you'll pay us. We do not do that at all. I'm very, very careful about that because credibility and integrity is what we put at the top of what we do. But we've been able to find a way to make money through partnerships. We make it very obvious. We recently redesigned our graphics so that we could bring our partnerships into it so that it's comfortable for people. It's not in your face, but in your face enough that you can actually see the logo, etc. And I think we've all become a bit used to that, haven't we? Like we're all doing Skypes these days with the Skype sitting in the top corner, etc. We don't mind logos anymore. So that kind of helps us out.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of what made me think about HuffPost Live, which much like your service, it's running more or less linear channels. It's running their dedicated programming, but also it wasn't carrying advertising as far as I remember. It's been a few years since it was streaming. But the thing with that service right. was that it was really there as a brand building exercise, really. So people were constantly engaging with the HuffPost brand. And so that yeah. constantly came back to the mm-hmm. website, which was advertising driven. And, you know, there's other models there involved. Now, I was thinking about Ticker, like, can it actually survive as its own thing? Or is maybe the long-term plan actually to align it with another publisher with similar intents of scale and ambition that Ticker has and try to take it beyond just an offer of video and actually be a bit more integrated? Or maybe further to that is the plan maybe for Ticker to not necessarily just be video, but to expand itself out into further types of media?
It's a good question. I'm opportunistic, so I would never say no. Mm. Nothing has presented itself to me so far that's made me want to jump. I've had a lot of people. The thing is, right, is when you create a success in media, or probably in any business, you find yourself going from excited to becoming a very quickly a gatekeeper because so many people come, want to be part of it, but want to change it. And you sit there and you listen to them. And Janine Ellis at Boost Juice talks about how when she first started the business, someone said to her, you know, why don't you add donuts to it? Like, that'd be a really great thing. You'd make so much money. And she said, but then we're not a juice company. We're a donut company. Mm. I think at the moment, you really want to be able to tell the market exactly what you are. And for us, news on the top half hour, programs in the back half hour, which reach under 45s, who are engaged in tech and entertainment and news and business, is what we're about. I could see a time, like sometimes I pinch myself and I go, I can't believe we are the only dedicated news streamer in this country when you have such strong brands out there like Channel 7 and Channel 9. But there is no way, I believe, that they would be able to make this financially work to the point that it's worth their while. Like 7 does really well with their Facebook watch bulletins, but how do they make any money out of it? There are no ads in it. They've got to make money out of it. Otherwise, for them, with all their extremely high costs, there's just no point doing it. So we are constantly developing what we're doing. We're working with distributors right now about getting Ticker onto other platforms in more places. We want to own the university market, for example, because we think that that's a place where our viewers would be, where people think. Anywhere people think, anywhere people work is where we want Ticker to be.
Final question. I'm thinking about your two idealized people, which was Joel and Lucy. That's not right, is it?
Emily.
Joel and Emily. You've got Joel and Emily. Yeah. They're both working for their bank during the daytime. But I'm thinking about the content offering on Ticker, which seems very heavily focused on that daytime period. Are you thinking about Joel and Emily as being people who've got the stream happening in like one window on their browser that they shouldn't be looking at while they're actually working? Or is the idea that that content's sort of out there so people can watch offline when they have the time to really indulge and focus on Ticker specifically?
It's actually a really great question and one that I very much focus on. So let's imagine to start with that they both, you know, get up and they do their exercise in the morning and Joel heads into work on the train when, of course, we can do that. And he's watching Ticker with the morning program, which I host to get him up to date with everything.
The subtext I'm hearing is that you've got a plan for an aerobics Oz style program launching on Ticker TV soon. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and I'm actually looking for a host. So how would you feel about jumping up and getting involved?
Look, I've got the Lycra just waiting. I've just been looking for the opportunity. Here we go.
Fantastic. That's great. I've got it waiting too. So, you know, they get to work and then Ticker is a sort of channel that you would have on in the office in the background. It's going to tell you what's happening in the markets if you've got a share portfolio, as the people that we talk to probably would. So we'll be keeping you up to date on that right throughout the day. We are live on LinkedIn. So if you're sitting on LinkedIn, which is probably the only, you know, social media platform that you're allowed to look at in most workplaces, we're live on there as it's happening. We've got clips that are constantly being churned out on there as well. So you can watch it in clip form or in live form. everything we do is designed to be catch up and live at the same time. So we literally sit and brainstorm ways, how will this work on both platforms? When I host, I'm thinking not just of the people who are watching live, but I'm literally creating in and out points in my own hosting for our social media team to be able to chop that up and get it out there as well. So that goes through to 5 p.m. in the afternoon. We replay the Ben Robber Robbo show, which is for people on their way home on the train, so that they can have a bit of fun with it as well, which gives them a bit of an entertainment side. Because we believe that people who work hard also, guess what, happen to be interested in showbiz and entertainment and sport. We're not one-dimensional, and that's, I guess, what I mean when I talk about a lot of media organizations that I watch. I feel like they've gone for a niche of a person, and they can't imagine that one person could like two different things, that someone could be professional and also like pop. I'm always reminded of the night that the ABC, when Michael Jackson died, and the ABC didn't lead with Michael Jackson dying. They led with, you know, another story to which I can't at all remember. And I try and imagine in the newsroom, they would have been having a conversation going, you know, we can't lead with this pop story. It's too pop for us. And it just, like, of course, the whole world wanted to know that day that Michael Jackson had died. And that's exactly the kind of, just because you are serious or a serious person, or you have serious conversations, doesn't mean you're not also interested in Michael Jackson dying. And that's what Ticker is. We don't have these fast and steady rules as to what we believe the audience cares about. We believe that the audience has lots of different circles that they care about. And by producing 20 of them, we hope that each of our viewers will be able to find at least 3 or 4, which keeps them coming back. And we are planning a nighttime network as well. But, like, I'll be quite honest, I want you to be watching Stan. I want you to be watching whatever entertains you. The Ticker app that sits on my Apple TV sits between my Netflix and my binge. This isn't trying to kill Sky News. It's not trying to kill the ABC. We're not trying to kill KO. We want to be with them. We see ourselves as being part of the media world, not this silly competition that we're in Australia where it's like this fight till death in the media world.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure you've got the savage whereabouts to necessarily make it as a media executive in Australia. However, you've got a future in the Oz aerobic style show that I want to pitch to you sometime soon. It's going to be the two of us. We're going to look great there on our Lycra. I'm very excited.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, at least we'll be able to make an Air New Zealand safety video while we're doing it or something.
Look, there's nothing safe about the way that I do aerobics. I'm going to warn you about that right now. But Aaron, thanks so much for your time. As I said, I think Tick is incredibly promising and exciting. I really want to see what that next stage is of the service. But yeah, people can find it on whatever platform. So LinkedIn, Twitter, just download the app.
Yeah, download the app, head to YouTube, subscribe there. We've got a website as well, tickertv.com.au. Basically, we want to be anywhere that you get your content.
Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm really keen to hear from you on the Oz Media Report podcast. If you come visit www.ozmedia.report, you'll be directed to our podcast host at Anchor. While you're there, you can click a button and leave us a voicemail. Let me know what you think of the podcast, but what I'd be super keen to hear from you about is your thoughts on the media. If you've got a broad statement you want to make that goes for roughly about 20-odd seconds, leave it on a voicemail. I might be able to use it on a show. Speaking of which, here's a voicemail from our first episode from Australian comedian, host of the Irrational Fear podcast, and all-round scallywag, Dan Illich.
G'day, Dan. Congratulations on the first episode of the Australian Media Report. Finally, someone is covering media in Australia with a podcast. Finally, another podcast. I just want to be the first person to say congratulations using this recording thing. And I want you to be able to maybe even turn my voice into a sting, you know, like they do on commercial radio. So something like, hey, it's Dan Illich here. You're listening to the Australian Media Report with Dan Barrett. Or, hey, it's Taylor Swift. You're listening to the Australian Media Report with Dan Barrett. Maybe use the other one.
I'm not much of a gamer. I suddenly play the occasional thing. If there's a big AAA game out, I'll often give it a look and lose a few weeks of my life. In the last year, I've had a great time with Red Dead Redemption 2, The Last of Us Part 2, and the recent Spider-Man PS4 game. But despite the improved special effects and expansive maps that I explore in these video game worlds, it doesn't feel like my experience is all that different to what I was playing 10, 15 years ago. With new generation game consoles announced by Sony and Microsoft in recent weeks, I spoke with the editor of tech publication Byteside, Seamus Byrne, about the new consoles and just how modern they actually are. Seamus, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Look, let's start with the new consoles. Tell me a little bit about the new machines. I understand that for the very first time, there's the ability to go purely digital without the need for physical media.
Yeah, that's right. Both Xbox and PlayStation are offering digital-only versions of their consoles. I mean, it's funny that even back in, what, about 7 years ago when Xbox One and PlayStation 4 first came out, we were all sort of thinking, oh, why are they still keeping the discs around? Well, some people were. I think I thought it made sense then, but it makes a lot of sense now that they've decided, okay, we've still got the disc version for people who want that, but now here we're offering the disc-free version. In the Xbox's case, it is actually also a bit more of a kind of cut-down machine that they're aiming to kind of really hit at a super aggressive price point. It isn't like perfect 4K resolution and things like that, which a lot of people, you know, apparently seem to kind of want as that kind of, you know, key thing about next gen. Whereas PlayStation has gone with the digital edition of the PlayStation 5 is just exactly the same thing. It just doesn't have the Blu-ray drive in it. So yeah, this is kind of an interesting step forward.
How is it being received by consumers? So I would assume there's probably a bunch of people concerned about the fact that if you go and buy a game from a physical store with a disc, you can generally shop around and there's usually a lot of day one sales to be found with your AAA, your major big titles. Whereas if you're buying it digitally, there's the exclusivity where you can only get it from the PlayStation store, you can only get it from the Xbox store. And so the prices then are standard RRP. So what are people generally saying? Because anecdotally, my friends are saying, I'm getting the discs because it's going to pay for itself eventually.
Yeah, I feel like the disc-free versions are going to suit people who maybe haven't... I'm going to accuse them of having not thought it through all that much, right? It's almost that, that mistake people make when they sort of calculate saving $100 now versus the lifetime of this device. Because exactly as you say, whether it is the idea that you will always be paying the price that PlayStation has set in the PlayStation store, yeah, sometimes the sales and things, but sales never seem to be as aggressive as going to, you know, JB or Big W or something like that to kind of score a brand new game. Yeah, brand new games will never be on sale in the PlayStation or the Xbox store, whereas you can often pick those up. And you're right, that $5 or $10 here or there absolutely will add up to the difference in that console price over life. But also, PlayStation is kind of notorious in Australia for the fact that they didn't have good local servers available to download games. And that would mean that anytime you had to download an update, let alone, you know, downloading the game the day you bought it, it would take ages. And look, maybe that was one thing that you didn't really notice was their problem when we were back on ADSL and things were already slow at our end. But as more people have gotten onto NBN and have started to get to 50 meg and 100 meg connections, that's when you start to notice, it's like, wait, this isn't my connection that's causing the problem. This is Sony's server being slow. And that's the kind of people who are now sort of going, well, until they can tell me they definitely have fast servers locally, I'm going to get the disc version.
And how many more years do you think that they'll be able to get away with having a dedicated store where you can only get the game from the official store? Because surely anti-competition laws come to it at a certain point.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting, I think, when, you know, I mean, everything we're seeing being argued about Apple at the moment is, I think, you know, it's not as, well, no one's willing to fight the console makers yet about this stuff. I guess that's probably the best way to put it, because there is at least a bit of a competition around being able to, you know, buy it in a store or different things. And I guess in a lot of ways, they've just treated that space differently. You know, Epic has kind of said it just thinks of consoles as a completely different thing, and that's why it's not attacking them and it's only attacking Google and Apple. But I think once these things become all digital, it does kind of become more of that question of how do you fight back against, you know, whatever their cut is, if the only way you can sell it is through their store and there's no other alternate means. So I think at some point that fight might end up coming up in that space as well.
Yeah, and you've got to think that Microsoft, who own Xbox, will be sensitive to this very issue, because obviously they had their own antitrust issues taking place from the late 90s onwards.
Yeah, and look, I think one thing that we do need to kind of think about with this next gen of consoles is Xbox is actually starting to take a really different approach. There's almost like a service idea here with Xbox. You know, when you can buy Xbox All Access as, you know, that new way where here in Australia, it's through Telstra. You can go onto a plan over 24 months. You will own the console, but you will also get a subscription to the Game Pass Ultimate, which means you now have a library of games available to you. You don't even have to buy games anymore. They'll just serve you up the games that they've put in the collection, and a bit like Netflix or whatever, different things will swap in and out now and then. But suddenly people are thinking, oh, well, I just get a bunch of games and I don't even need to think about going and forking out more money. I just pay a subscription fee. That is something that Xbox is really trying to get bedded in with the next generation, whereas PlayStation is still focused on that idea of saying, we're going to sell you a console and then we will sell you games. They're playing a little bit of sort of catch up by adding in some, you know, PlayStation 4 games that you'll get included with your annual subscription. But this is something Xbox is kind of really trying to aggressively move to. And that does then change that whole discussion of what, you know, what, how do you compete in a store like that? It's like, well, it's now a subscription service. So that would be more like then debating, you know, are you competing? Is Netflix having an antitrust problem if you can't be in their store or something like that?
Oh, look, absolutely. So the fact that there are new approaches to delivering a game experience to people, it's kind of what I'm really interested in talking to you about, which is that, look, I'm looking at these machines and I'm seeing it as a iterative improvement on what I've seen in previous generations, but I'm not really seeing the things that seem to reflect, because I'm not a huge gamer, but I look at the marketplace and I think about what seems to be like the current sort of state of games, which is a lot more online gaming. I'm seeing Twitch as the cultural bedrock of gaming these days. I'm looking at esports on the rise and that sort of cut through to the mainstream. All these elements are heavily tied to video gaming, but I'm looking at these new consoles and I'm like, well, it just seems like the same experience that we've had previously. So are people looking at these as being a little bit sort of old dated and not really keeping up with the cultural needs of gamers? Or are people happy to sort of delineate and say, look, I've got this experience which is being handled over here, but these new gen consoles, I'm happy with, you know, what they're providing for me over here without the crossover?
Yeah, like I kind of think, look, the fact that all the pre-orders for, you know, PlayStation 5 are kind of sold out through to the start of next year now, apparently, even, you know, just within the first few days, that hardcore fan base loves this stuff and they want that extra resolution. They want, you know, they want, I guess, a true 4K experience at a high frame rate, because that was kind of, I guess, the thing of the last gen was, yeah, it could deliver, you know, you had to get a PlayStation Pro before you could get 4K. Likewise, Xbox One X. So they kind of had these, you know, 0.5 edition consoles that came in halfway through that last gen. If you wanted to genuinely be able to play something on a 4K TV that felt native, and so this is, in a sense, that first generation of people getting really high frame rate, true 4K technology in their console. And I'm more of a PC gamer. You know, I have all the consoles, but I've always kind of tended towards PC gaming. But I can completely understand that there are people who are like, this is that one thing I invest in every, you know, half a decade, and I put it under my TV and that's where I play my games. And so having over this last decade, people now have really good 4K TVs. I can kind of understand for that crowd of real people who want that, you know, best looking experience possible, that they want that. But in terms of, yeah, the styles of games we're going to get, in terms of any really clear tech advances, there's kind of not really been anything, you know, during this kind of last 5 years that has changed, except just now being able to say, you know, throw in all of the really sort of top end features for audio and for picture quality, and then let developers kind of work out what are you going to do with it from here?
Yeah, because I'm thinking about your Facebooks of the world. I'm thinking about Apple. There's a lot of quiet conversations that are getting a little bit louder and louder, where they're talking now about augmented reality. They're talking about virtual reality, which obviously PlayStation's had the PlayStation VR, which has launched to moderate success a couple of years ago, but it hasn't really been like a major sort of revolutionary change for gaming. But if you've got Apple involved and you've got Facebook and both of them are pushing AR and VR experiences, surely you're going to start looking at these consoles in the next 18 months to 2 years, thinking that it's a little bit old hat because you've got these exciting game experiences happening over here, and yet you're still there playing your platform or whatever the case might be on your sort of supposed next-gen consoles.
Yeah, and look, this is where I feel like what's going on at Xbox actually makes the most sense, because part of that subscription service is actually going to be access to their xCloud gaming service. And that is the whole idea where all of those games in that library that you get access to on an Xbox through the Game Pass Ultimate, you will also be able to play those. You know, you can play the PC versions of those games, but you will also then be able to play them through the new game streaming service where they do all of the number crunching up in the cloud. All they're sending to you is, you know, this kind of high speed, essentially video stream of the game that you're playing. Knowing that particularly when 5G hits, you can then have low latency responses from a controller right there in your hand, and you'll be able to play this stuff on a mobile. So this is launching on Android first because they're in a big fight with Apple over the fact that Apple doesn't want to let people do cloud streaming services controlled in that sort of a way. But it certainly shows that if you think again on that, you know, 2 to 3 year timeline, and again, you know, they're trying to sell people this nice 2 year subscription to get them comfortable. By the other end of that, then I think it starts to become more of a thing where Xbox starts to be a lot less worried about whether or not you bought their piece of hardware and more the idea that they will serve you games wherever you want to access them.
Yeah, because obviously they don't make the money on the hardware. They make it on the game sales, the licensing, and yeah, the subscriptions. I'm thinking about the most exciting bit of hardware tech slash software platform that I've seen, at least announced so far, which comes to the Nintendo Switch of all places. It's a new game called Mario Kart Live, I think Home Edition. I think that's what it's called. It's essentially a little remote control Mario Kart, which you drive around your house, you film your house, and then you get to play it as Mario Kart on your Nintendo Switch console. And that to me is an exciting mix of AR and a traditional gaming experience. But I'm not hearing about that kind of thing coming from these supposed next generation consoles.
Yeah, and look, you know, when we think back to particularly the Wii was that moment when, you know, Nintendo had sort of, they'd let the whole kind of console world just kind of run past them for a long time. You know, the GameCube didn't work out all that well for them. And so people wondering, oh, what's Nintendo going to do next? And like since that time when, you know, every household had a Wii and it was about the motion control and that lovely packed in Wii Sports game that so many people, I think they only ever owned the Wii and a Wii Sports, and that was it. That's all they wanted. But since then, they played so much more with a lot of this stuff, you know, the 3DS with kind of 3D on the small screen for portable gaming, the Switch being this, you know, kind of what they, the Nintendo Wii U wasn't. It's like now you have the actual portable Nintendo console that's a true console. I completely get, you know, they even had this like Nintendo Labo thing that it's like this weird kind of robotic VR kind of gaming thing made out of cardboard that you can get for the Switch.
It's like a craft project where kids had to actually assemble and build it themselves. And
So like they've been really playing with ideas that kind of have nothing to do with how good is the resolution and how good, like I kind of love that they've abandoned that idea of trying to say, well, we're going to give you the perfect resolution on your new TV. They're just saying, what's fun? What's the next fun thing that we could play with? And I totally get that this, you know, Mario AR game where it starts to, you know, like you're driving it like a drone racing car, but then on that screen, it's like putting up the lights of the barriers and things around your house. So you can kind of genuinely feel like you're playing a Mario Kart game with a real remote control car. I think that playfulness, I think, is something that absolutely is always kind of more attractive than when people just get super serious about just delivering more pixels.
Yeah. Now, look, you've got me nostalgic. I want to go and dust off my Wii, play a bit of tennis. I'm desperate to do that, but I'm going to leave you with one more question, which is, do you think it's the last gen of consoles as we know them before they start evolving into new things, or maybe no console at all in a case of Xbox as they move purely towards being a platform for subscriptions?
Yeah, I think things will continue to change a lot. I partly wonder, because again, we had these sort of the Pro models and the X models and things appear halfway through the last gen. I almost suspect that Xbox is heading more towards something where it's almost like a PC that sits under your TV, and they'll sort of just maybe start to more progressively upgrade it. You know, they keep emphasizing the idea that they're kind of offering more backwards compatibility in a way that actually PlayStation is just saying, actually, you will never play PlayStation 1, 2, or 3 games on the new one. It's all about going forwards. And of course, you know, that gives companies perfect license to just remaster everything and make you pay for it all over again. But I think PlayStation might end up being that one last kind of hardcore console that exists over the long run. You know, they outsold Xbox in this current generation worldwide. I think it will sort of potentially be that thing where they are that kind of hardcore stalwarts of having the console, and Xbox starts to be more of a game platform that works on anything, wherever you might want to play it. You just give them your subscription dollars and they'll deliver you cool games wherever you might want to get them.
Yeah, well, I'm desperate to play these Spider-Man Miles Morales games. So I've got my $750. Like, that's going to happen. But I think this might be the last console for me. Anyway, Seamus, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And let's just quickly give a plug to Biteside, which is your current publishing empire. So it's a weekly newsletter, it's podcasts. What else have you got happening?
Yeah, so now I've got a team of writers working alongside me at Biteside.com. So if you look up Biteside in any podcast app, you'll see the set of Biteside podcasts there. There's the weekly newsletter, and you can find all that stuff at Biteside.com.
CNET lookout. Seamus, thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan.
That's it from me for another week. Thanks for listening. My plan is to be back here again next week with another episode. I hope you've got a very similar plan. Big thanks to guests this week, Aaron Young and Seamus Byrne. I thought both conversations were incredibly insightful. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already done so. We're in all of your major podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Casts, etc., etc., etc. You can find me on Twitter at TheDanBarrett and over at my daily screen culture newsletter, which you can find at alwaysbewatching.com. Let's talk more media again next week.